Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. President Meyerson, Chairman Donald Regan, members of the Board of Trustees, the members of the administration and the faculty of this great university, Chaplain Johnson, the distinguished students from all the many schools, professional schools, those in the liberal arts and programs. This is someday, I'll tell you that. This is someday. I've given more speeches than any man ought to be permitted to. I have bored more people over a longer period of time than any man ought to be permitted to. And when I come to make a commencement address, despite the number of speeches I've made, the acquaintanceship that I seem to feel with the whole business of public speaking, I shake all over. I don't know what to say, and you'll soon find out that I've told you the truth. When I heard that this was the 221st commencement, that's history, 20 years plus before our independence, and this great university representing higher education in the building of this republic, I think it tells us something right quickly. As Thomas Jefferson said, you cannot be both ignorant and free. And we decided early in this republic that we would be informed, that we would concentrate resources and attention upon education. And there's no finer example of the generosity of the American public and the dedication of truly fine people than what has happened here at the University of Pennsylvania over these many years. And I congratulate all of those that have made it possible, this great university with a tremendous budget that tells us that somebody had to be mighty generous. Now, my graduate friends, it was 38 years ago that I was out there like you are at the University of Minnesota getting my Bachelor of Arts degree. We had a lot of graduates that year too. And for the life of me, I can't remember what the commencement speaker said. And I'll bet you that when you leave here at least a year from now, you're going to say, who was that fellow? What did he say? And that's why it's a challenge to me to try to say something to you that'll be worthy of your time and your attention. Bob Hope, the great American comedian, was addressing the Georgetown University graduating class here a few years ago, and he looked out over that audience, not as large as this, but a great audience, and he said, to those of you that are about to graduate and go out into this world of ours, my advice to you is, don't go. But I'm afraid we got to get rid of you. We have to make room for new students. You have to go. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the country and the world into which you're going to go, even though you've already been very much a part of it. There is really no separation, you know, by age. We're a part of our community from the date of our birth. That old cynic, and, well, I guess that's the best way to put it, or skeptic Aldous Huxley, he said, I have peered into the future. It won't work. There's always people like that, you know. But the real truth is that we have to make it work. And that's what you're here for. That's why you went on to the university. That's why so many of you have struggled hard to achieve the goals that you've already achieved and new goals ahead of you. So we're going to make it work. I've been reminded by President Meyerson of the day that I was here in July 1948. Boy, was it hot, more ways than one. I was the young mayor of the city of Minneapolis, as he said. But in my heart, I had something I wanted to tell my fellow partisans, and I did. And I said to them at that time, it is time for America to walk out of the shadows of states' rights into the bright sunlight of human rights. And ladies and gentlemen, it is still the time for us to do just that. The interesting thing is that when I said that, a large segment of the audience got up and left. I thank you for staying. You're kind and you're courteous. But it was an interesting time and a very historic time in American politics. Because this whole nation is the story of what happened here in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia story, really in two chapters, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States. Beautiful, magnificent doctrines and documents that lay before the American people, not accomplishment as much as challenge. And from here on out, that's what it's all about. Challenge. Now this year marks the celebration, doesn't it, of our entrance into that third century of our independence and of our aspiration to be a democracy. And that in itself makes this graduating class of 1977 unique. Many of you will move directly into the mainstream of economic life and professional life. Others will continue your education seeking advanced degrees. But all of you are part of a world of increasingly complex problems, on parallel challenges, and above all, extraordinary opportunity. Most everybody will tell you about the problems. And they're going to be here, and they have been with us ever since the beginning of time. But there is, with every challenge, a chance to do something, and we call it opportunity. Now, my remarks today are directed towards defining the world you stand to inherit. And I do mean world, not nation, because the fact is that we no longer can talk about American policy as an isolated subject sufficient unto itself. What happens or what fails to happen in America has a major impact on the rest of the world. And what happens in the rest of the world has a significant impact upon us. Surely we learned that out of the Middle East oil crisis and embargo of 1973. And we learn it every day. The basic reality of today is that we are solidly entrenched, not only in the period of independence, which this city symbolizes, but we are solidly entrenched into an era of interdependence, an era in which domestic and global distinctions have become increasingly blurred. And we are fast approaching the time when domestic and foreign policy concerns are one and inseparable. Now, I speak to you primarily as a public man. There is no way that you can legislate, for example, something for us in America without its impact abroad. And I come from the Midwest. I'm here to what happens in the Middle East may have more impact on the life of my children and my grandchildren than anything that happens in the Midwest. Therefore, we need to be not only citizens of this republic, but we need to be knowledgeable individuals and hopefully citizens of this world. Interdependence, that's the word, it's the catchword of the 1970s, commonly used, and I wonder if fully understood. The post-war world, that is World War II foreign policy of this nation, has focused on the maintenance of what we call the traditional balance of power, our concern primarily with the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc. And as we enter this third century, protection against military threats still remain a serious matter and a matter of major foreign policy focus of our nation. However, our national security, and that's what your life is going to be all about, our national security is endangered by events outside of the political and military sphere of the major powers. The advances of modern technology have reduced the time and spatial distances between peoples and nations to relative insignificance. And in so doing, it has increased the magnitude and the importance of interaction among peoples, among nations, and we are no longer immune from this interaction. The oceans are no longer a barrier. They are a bridge, a conduit. The problems of energy, material resources, environment, employment, inflation, population, hunger, disease, and illiteracy, and you've heard a lot about it. The question of the use of the space above us and the seas below us and the trends in nuclear proliferation and terrorism, all these issues are within the spectrum of your lifetime, and they threaten our security as a country, along with the possibility of nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union. We are compelled, therefore, to recognize some new facts: that no one nation dominates or controls the international scene. And it's imperative that we get that clear. Our relations with the developing countries, the poorest of the poor, countries far away, the names of which you can't even pronounce, are fast becoming a major concern of our foreign policy, and rightly so. It is also clear that the importance of America's economic relations with these developing countries, Africa, Asia, Latin America, countries in faraway places, that those economic relationships become more important and grow. Our nation sells more of its goods to these poor developing countries than to the European Community, Eastern Europe, and the Soviet Union all combined. And the developing countries provide us with both the critical raw materials that we need and essential consumer goods. If for no other reason than self-protection, we must accept the doctrine of interdependence. The industrial nations, of course, quite understandably, are reluctant to accept any major changes in the world order. We've been built on the idea of free trade and the movement of capital, and we've done well under it. However, it is equally understandable that these new countries, 150 of them, frustrated as they are so often in their attempts to improve their standards of living, are convinced that the current international economic system has worked to their disadvantage. So we find that the poorer countries no longer are willing to be dependent upon our generosity of foreign aid, particularly when they know that it varies according to the political climate year by year. Instead, they want a more predictable foundation for their economic growth. And what do they want? What you and I want: an assurance of a fair price for their commodities and a guaranteed access to the world markets for their goods. And they not only want it, they are demanding it. In essence, the developing countries are insisting upon a genuine commitment by the industrial nations of which we are the leader to the principle of economic equity, justice between all nations. Now, the demand for change, yes, fundamental and radical change, has been coming for a long, long time. It's like a gathering storm and it has now arrived in all of its fury. We see it in Latin America and Africa, particularly. We had hoped that it might pass away, or that minor little adjustments here and there might take care of things. But it didn't. Our hopes are understandable. Change never comes easy. And change on a global basis is threatening. It's unsettling. And very frankly, often revolutionary. But the fact is that the balance of this century will continue to be a period of incredible, massive change in political, economic, and social institutions, and you're going to have to live with it and help shape it. The question, therefore, is, will we, this great America, that gave the world such a marvelous message 200 years ago, will we help to influence and affect this global upheaval in a direction consistent with our values and beliefs, or will we merely resist it, dig in, put our head in the sand? Simply put, will we design our future, or will we simply resign ourselves to it? Now, it's my judgment, if the United States is to develop an effective, positive response to the demands of the less developed countries, then we must face up to some startling and shocking facts on the international scene. Today, there are 700 million adults in the world unable to read or write, totally illiterate. Today, there are 1.5 billion people in the world that have no health care whatsoever. Today, there are over 500 million people in the world that suffer from severe hunger and dangerous malnutrition. Today, there are a majority of the people in the world that are ill-housed, and almost the same that are ill-fed and ill-clothed. And I say to this graduating class and to this audience, as an American that is concerned about his country, that without a major effort by the international community, some 800 million of the world's poorest have no reason to expect any improvement in their condition of life for the rest of this century. Now, these are the facts of our time, and there are many more that could shock us. And these cruel, ugly facts are as threatening to your future and my future, but particularly to yours, as an uncontrolled arms race. These are the time bombs which threaten global peace. As Pope John the 23rd so dramatically put it, in a world of constant want, there is no peace. Therefore, we must be willing to respond to these threats, as we are willing to respond and face the threat of military aggression. But the fact is that we don't. Listen to this. Last year, the development assistance programs, the economic assistance programs of all of the free world to the developing countries totaled approximately $17 billion. In the same time span, more than $285 billion was spent on the military. Bombs, missiles, planes, guns. That's the way the priorities are today. The question, therefore, that we must decide is whether or not the conditions of social and economic injustice, poverty, illiteracy, disease, and all that it brings are a real threat to our security. I think they are. And if they are, then they require the same commitment of policy, will, and resources as the so-called conventional national defense. This is an awesome challenge, and people don't like to face up to it. And it's a challenge that's going to require planning and a daring of an all-out attack as if you were fighting for your very existence. But I'm here to tell you that it can be done if it is international in its design and its application. World hunger. Well, world hunger cannot be conquered just by American charity, important as our contribution might be, but by modern technology and improved production of food and fiber on a worldwide basis with a great commitment, world hunger can be conquered. Disease can be conquered, or at least its ravages minimized. The modern world knows how to do this if we have the will, if we'll provide the manpower, the woman power, the means, the resources, we can do it. The basic changes in our international financial institutions, which were designed for a world of yesterday at Bretton Woods, the time of World War II, they're obsolete, out of date, and they can and they must be modernized and expanded so as to provide the capital which is needed for development. Because the new word for peace is development. Now, we've had some experience in all of this. This is not all a lot of gibberish and just say, well, I mean, there he is up there just talking about what we ought to do. The fact is, we've done some of it. A war-torn Europe, devastated, annihilated, mutilated, was rebuilt by the Marshall Plan. But it required commitment. It required a plan. It required resources. And it required cooperation. And it required leadership. A highly nationalistic Europe, balkanized as they called it, was brought together in the European Economic Community by strong political leadership and imagination, motivated by economic necessity. You see, it is possible to make changes. The question is, are you going to do it on your deathbed, or are you going to do it while you still have time? We have demonstrated there are few, if any, physical or technological barriers that this country is incapable of overcoming, provided that we're willing to make a national commitment to do so. And then remember this, my fellow Americans. We're not alone. We don't own this world. We have no monopoly on brains and talent. There's a whole world out there of skill and talent and resources that needs to be mobilized and called to the task. What's it all add up to? What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that if we go about this world admitting at least to ourselves and frequently proclaiming to the world that we're a leader, then we have to lead. And leadership is not command. Leadership is persuasion, precept and example, moral fortitude, guts, courage, adventurism, initiative. Oh, what an exciting time to be alive. I envy all you young folks out there. Good Lord, it's going to be so much is going to happen these next 20, 25 years. And I'll be darned if I don't think the good Lord's going to cheat me out of some of it. You really got something ahead of you. You've come through a very difficult time, but it's always been that way. I don't cry any tears for that. I have three sons and a daughter, and I've heard them tell me about the tough times they're having. I said, what's new? What's new? When were the good old days? I'll tell you when the good old days are, the further you're away from them. That's when the good old days are. So much is happening, and oh, it happens so fast, of course, it overruns us in technology and science alone. But it is in the political, economic, and social fields where it's going to be interesting, for mankind's ingenuity and inventiveness will be tested and must be directed. And who are we afraid? Who are we to be afraid of trying? Look, we are the most inventive people in the world. Oh, we didn't invent the wheel, I know that. But I tell you what we did do, right in this city, we invented a practical working adaptation of the doctrine of self-government. Government by the consent of the governed. And we did it at a time when the world was dominated by the philosophy of the divine right of kings. We broke with the past. We cut it off. We severed it. And we proclaimed to the world that people were not things and property, but they were the instruments of a divine providence. We enunciated the doctrine of God-given natural rights, and we said that governments had only one justification, and that is how they secured and protected those rights of life and of liberty and the pursuit of the happiness. So we are adventuresome, we were at least, and I don't want this graduating class to be any less daring. The age of pioneering is not over. Oh, I know you don't have to get in a covered wagon and go across the desert and over the Rocky Mountains and fight the Indians. That's over, I hope. Once in a while when I see John Wayne, I'm not sure, but I think it's over. But as was said, the era of pioneering is not over. It's just that the arena of pioneering has changed. And how many of you here know that? Whether it's in art or music, or whether it's in medicine or law, or whether it's in architecture or design, or whether it is in the dance or whatever it may be, constantly new forms. We have to be willing to be as innovative in the political and the economic processes as we are in what I have just mentioned. We're an experimental people. We've been running the greatest experiment the world has ever known, and we're still waiting for all the results, because the work of democracy is never completed. A heterogeneous people from all over the world of every different race, creed, nationality, background, trying to get one nation without losing our respective identities. It's a great experiment, but we've been doing pretty well. We're the oldest democracy on the face of the earth. We've been able to go through incredible periods of corruption and trauma, of secession and war and depression and panic, of abuse of power and every conceivable thing from Vietnam to Watergate and God knows what. And we have survived. And we have learned. Now, many people try to interpret this beautiful country of ours to the world as if it was nothing more or less than a country of wealth and power, military power. That's not America. We are pleased, we are grateful, Almighty, for our wealth. We need power in this troubled world. But the message of the United States is not nuclear power. It is not arms. It is not resistance to change. The message of the United States is one of adventure. It's one of experimentation. It's one of building. It's one of development. The message of the United States is a spiritual message, a bond between the sacred rights of the individual and a government that is to be responsive to that individual. Oh, there'll be those of you who say, well, I know, but that doesn't all work. Of course it doesn't all work. You want to know why? Because we're people. We louse it up. But the whole spirit, the whole test of democracy is trying to do better. Each generation adding a little something, making its own adjustments to this magnificent cathedral of democracy that is ours. And let me add this. We must continue to understand, or should I say we ought to begin to understand, that our nation's security is not to be found merely in the size of our military, but lies in the well-being of our people, at work. And I'm here to tell you that one of the most fearful foes that we have today is the denial of job opportunities to people that want a job, that want to work, that ought to be contributing to this economy. That's a danger to us. Why, if we knew we had 7 million communists in the United States today, we'd have 40 committees in Congress investigating it. But we got 7.5 million people unemployed. And we're trying to tell ourselves that, well, in due time, this will work its way out. Let a man have nothing to do for his country, said John Stuart Mill, and he will have no love for it. Let millions of people be told there is no place for them, that they're not needed, they're not wanted. They'll have no love for that flag, because they've been told they're not needed. The real strength, then, of this nation is in its people. Its people educated, its people in sound and mental and physical health, its people that are erasing from their soul and their mind bigotry and intolerance. And of course, that was what we were trying to do here in 1948, just a little bit. Now, America's leadership and concern is a broad one, and it's in the area above all of human rights. But when we talk about human rights, we can't just talk about the right of free speech or the right to immigrate. It can't be that restrictive. For what are human rights if you have no income? What are human rights if your children are hungry? What are human rights if you have no opportunity for an education? What are human rights if you're forced to live in filth and slums and decadence? I ask America, as it proclaims human rights to the world, to cleanse its house. Let us be able to stand before the world as a shining example of real human rights. We've got to champion all of it, economic, political, and social. And this concern does not stop at our nation's shores. We cannot go around proclaiming democracy to the world and abandon these principles abroad. A sense of moral values has got to be an imperative of our foreign policy. And unless it is, we will find it difficult to gain the respect and the support of peoples around the globe who look to us as they struggle for their freedom. Here's what we offer to this world more than anything else: hope. Hope. And people live by hope. While it's true that we don't have the right to interfere in the internal affairs of other countries, this does not mean that we should not remind the world that human rights are the highest priority of the American people and their government. So let me conclude my little sermonette with these words of counsel from one who's made more than his fair share of mistakes, but who this very hour struggles to find a better way. I know that there's not going to be a quick fix to our problems. I know that there isn't going to be the utopia tomorrow. I know that the story of America is trying to do better. Even the founding fathers of this republic said, "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union." They didn't say a perfect union, a more perfect union. Each generation do better. But remember this, don't sell this country short. I'm not talking about now our commodities or our goods, even though we can be proud of that part of our development. America is a promise and a hope in the minds and the hearts of those who cherish liberty and yet suffer, who want justice and yet are oppressed, who cry out for opportunity and yet are denied. Mankind lives by hope. And we do not always get all we want when we want it. And you won't and I won't. I found that out. I wanted one or two big things in this country and I didn't get it. But I say that we have to believe that someday, somehow, some way, it will be better, and that we can make it so. Surely we're not going to give in to the pessimists. I have little or no time for them. These people that have intellectual gastritis, looking as if they're constantly bothered. There's nothing wrong with having a smile on your face and some sense of confidence. That doesn't mean you ignore the realities of life. It means that you're prepared to deal with them. My message to you is simply this. We face great problems. God only knows we do. Both here at home and in the world. But I submit to you that we can and we will, if we so design it, overcome them. We can launch a global assault on the historic plagues of mankind that I've talked to you about. We can do it right from Philadelphia, the bondage of hunger, disease, and illiteracy, if we have the will to do so. And we can clean it up in America, if we have the will to do so. We have the means. Don't tell me that if we can rebuild the cities of Europe, battered, torn, destroyed by bomb and shell, that we're incapable of making the cities of America livable. Don't tell me that we can't. I grew up as a young man when a man by the name of Franklin Roosevelt was in the White House. And I suppose, like all of us, we have heroes. I was a Depression boy from the plains of South Dakota. It seemed hopeless. The winds tore up our land. The banks had failed. The people were unemployed. The nation's factories had stopped. That's when I went off to college. There wasn't much to look forward to. But we didn't cop out. The cowards cop out. And they're the ones that cop out. You've got to have the fortitude to stay the road. To stand the test and to recognize your limitations, but not to play upon them and constantly emphasize them. This cripple, this man, Mr. Roosevelt, who could not walk, this man that was a victim of paralysis and finally a victim of the war itself, said this in the darkest period of our nation, the only limit to our realization of tomorrow will be our doubts of today. And then listen, let us move forward with a strong and an active faith. And I charge this graduating class of 1977 to make up your mind that you individually and as a group collectively can help make this country a better and a decent, more decent place in which to live. And that through your efforts, whatever they may be, you'll help make this world a little better place to live. And if you make any contribution to that goal, you will have fulfilled what God's destiny was for you. Thank you very much.
Will you thank you, Martin?